Ed Hugler is Deputy Assistant Secretary for Operations at the Department of Labor, and he is a finalist for a Service to America Medal in the Management Excellence category. Ed, congratulations on your selection as a finalist. You were in the unfortunate position of learning that the Labor Department's financial services provider was about to go bankrupt. How did you go about triaging a situation like that and finding a solution? Thanks very much for your time today, Ed.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I very much appreciate being on your show. So let me give your listeners a little sense of scale here. Labor's financial management system handles $60 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars annually. It manages and keeps track of all the transactions, so when we pay our bills, it records that, it keeps a general ledger straight, it also makes grant funds available, so it is a very interactive and very heavily relied upon system for the department. The alternative in the absence of such an automated system would be literally pencil paper manual spreadsheets, which frankly would be unimaginable and probably not very effective. So when we were faced with that situation, we really kind of focused on the expected outcome, and that was failure is not an option here because the alternative is just simply unworkable. So what we did is we sat down with other federal agencies, and this is, you know, this is not something government's typically good at, and they, among them were GSA, the Treasury Department, naturally enough. Not so naturally, but still important, was the Department of Transportation, because they were set to be our new shared service provider. So we were going to move off our legacy system and move over to transportation and use theirs on a fee-for-service basis. And then we also had OMB involved, because obviously we got a lot of money at stake. So we sat down and said, okay, failure's not going to be an option here. Yeah, we'll have a manual failover plan, but that's not where we're going to end up. What we ended up doing in about 8 months' period of time is we the government, purchased the private sector asset from the failing company. We had the operations then staffed by the Department of Transportation, our future shared service provider. We had a handoff on the night of September 19th. We closed the fiscal year, which is just September 30th, without incident, and received a clean audit opinion at the end of the fiscal year. So I have to say, I don't take credit for that. It was a real demonstration of unparalleled coordination among large federal agencies, and a lot of creative thinking, and a few sleepless nights.
I imagine so, and I congratulate you on that level of achievement. One of the big lessons outside of the Labor Department that other agencies learned was be very careful about who holds the data rights to the information that a third party or an outside vendor holds. Within the Labor Department, throughout this effort, what did you take away personally, and what did you take away as a leader inside the Labor Department about how to manage a crisis situation like this, Ed?
Well, a fair question, and certainly you are right. You do need to be very cognizant of what arrangements you have and rights you have to your data. But aside from that, I really think that the management lessons learned here is you really have to establish what is the expected outcome in very clear and unambiguous terms. In this case, as I already said, we got a $60 billion, a system that handles $60 billion annually, and failure is simply not an option. That can't happen. So that was step one. The second is you got to stay focused on the outcome, particularly with complex problems like this. There's a very strong tendency for distraction and unhelpful digressions. I call them rabbit holes, just like in Alice in Wonderland. You have to screen out that noise. You have to stay focused on the stated outcome. And then you really just have to have a state of mind that says, we're not taking no for an answer. If failure's not an option, then you have to keep searching for yes until you find it. And the final lesson, I think, is you have to disregard the naysayers. There's plenty of them. Everybody said it can't be done, and you just can't listen to that. You have to prove them wrong.
How do you, okay, so you kind of answered my question partially, I guess, at the very end there. But how do you prove them wrong? How do you go about at least kind of quarantining the naysayers and making sure that that opinion doesn't spread around and create a perception as reality problem?
Yes, so I'll say it this way, and I want to make the right attribution. First thing is you need to stay calm. and display confidence. Because if people think you're rattled, then that just services this notion that it can't be done. And I'll quote Vince Lombardi. He said that confidence is contagious, and so is lack of confidence. So I think that was probably the backbone of why we were successful and how we tamped down the naysayers.
The profile that the Partnership for Public Service provided about you, Ed, says that one significant ongoing initiative involves updating the department's outmoded and inefficient IT infrastructure and talks about moving to a cloud email provider in 14 months. You must have a terrific partnership with Don Leaf, the CIO at the Labor Department.
Well, we sure do, and we're very, very happy and pleased to have Don Leaf as our CIO here. And you correctly give her the attribution for getting that done. We all know, experience every day, both at work and at home, how fast new technology moves, and it leaves then legacy systems like you talked about, email, really wanting in terms of what their capacity is. So in this case, our legacy system was certainly no match for the agility and storage of cloud email services that are available today. So we went to our staff, though, to get to why we did this. We went to our staff around the country and said, what can we do for you to improve, what improved technology would help you be more efficient and effective? Somewhat to my surprise, one of the top replies was more email storage. And what the employees did is they described the fact that they spent a lot of time, sometimes every day, deleting and cleaning up email to avoid exceeding the cap on their account and then being unable to send emails. And the condition became known among the people who talked about it to be called mail jail, as if in jail, mail jail.
Yeah.
So to make a long story short, as your question intimated, we went from procurement to deployment in 14 months, and our employees now have both new services. They have the size of their accounts are dramatically increased, and there is no more mail jail.
So Dawn's great, and she's talked to my colleague Jason on a number of occasions, but this is not just a two-person or two-team collaboration, because you're talking about procurement to execution, so you're involving a procurement shop, you're involving a CFO shop who's got to help you figure out how to pay for it, and I mean, this is a really everybody in the executive suite moving on these kinds of issues.
Yes, that's a good way to put it, and that's really one of the reasons I appreciate this. That management gets some recognition here, because all that behind the scenes work is really not terribly visible to most people, and it's thrilling, frankly, to me to see it get some attention. I don't want to make it sound like it's the Berlin airlift every day, but there are a lot of moving parts to make all these things happen, as your question intimates.
Your boss, the Secretary of Labor, Thomas Perez, says, what I like most about Ed is that he's always seeking to innovate. The idea of somebody constantly being on the lookout for places to innovate is really contrary, I think, to the stereotype that people have about government in general, but the federal government in particular. How do you force that through, I guess? How do you reinforce the idea that innovation is not just desirable but possible in an organization like a federal agency the size of the Labor Department, Ed?
Well, you know, I'll take a little bit of issue with the underlying premise that the federal government is not good at it. I think stereotype is exactly the right word, and I think it's an unfair stereotype. I work with people every day who are a heck of a lot smarter than me. They're very engaged, and they're very smart and very innovative, particularly some of the employees who are coming into the workforce, you know, just after college or even high school. So I think that stereotype is very unfairly applied. The government gets some of the most difficult problems to solve, and frankly, without an innovative and open mind about change, which really I think is the root of innovation, without that, we wouldn't be able to do all the things that we do. Sure, we make mistakes. Sure, sometimes we come up short. But I honestly do not think, and this is with 38 years of experience, I think that stereotype is just unfair and wrong.
I appreciate your distinction there between the stereotype and the reality, Ed. I note in your profile from the partnership something that I find particularly appealing and interesting, and that is the success story behind benefits.gov and then the way that you have taken those same ideas and applied them in other places. There's a logic that follows there that I think a lot of people may not necessarily see or appreciate.
Benefits.gov is a great example of what you're asking about. And I want to tell you a little bit about the what I'll call the early startup days of Benefit.gov. So we were tasked to be what was called then the managing partner for developing what now is known as Benefits.gov, which is just an online tool that people can use to determine very easily what benefits they may be eligible for. So for your listeners, let me just give you a little bit of background. So you go to Benefits.gov, and all you need to do is answer very simple questions about yourself that you know. Your age, your marital status, dependents, income, employment status, military service, maybe life events such as an illness or storm damage as examples. You just answer those questions. You don't need to be at your desk to look things up. These are things anybody would know. In a matter of seconds, Benefits.gov will tell you what you are likely to be eligible for and how to apply for those benefits. Now, what I find particularly good about that is that it solves a really impenetrable mystery of what benefits are available, who's eligible for them, and where the heck would you find them. Now, I'll make this point just to give your listeners something, a way to think about this. How many would guess that Head Start is administered by the Department of Health and Human Services and not Education?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could say, oh, but you could Google that and find out. Yeah, but it still doesn't help people who couldn't possibly know what benefits exist and what they're called. So, for example, there's a state crime victims compensation program run by the Department of Justice that reimburses victims for crime-related expenses. Who would know to ask for that? You can't Google that because you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
So I would encourage your listeners to check out benefits.gov. It's very nifty, and frankly, you can help other people that you may need help by just alerting them to this solution.
And the logic that I found attractive that followed that, Ed, is this passage from your profile. He later championed the idea of using benefits.gov technology for similar citizen-centric solutions, including govloans.gov, disasterassistance.gov, best.ssa.gov. It sounds like the simple solution there was, well, this is the same process, and we could apply the same service solution to the same process.
That's exactly right. In fact, we have people lining up right now today, and FEMA and their disasterassistance.gov is one of them, to expand the services that benefits.gov runs for them. And we just finished an agreement with Interior to stand up their new native one-stop service, which again would be powered by benefits.gov.
Well, I congratulate you on this terrific career of work on behalf of the American people, and I congratulate you and your colleagues especially on your selection as a finalist for a Service to America Medal. Ed, it's been a pleasure to talk to you and learn about your work.
Well, it's been a pleasure being with you, and thank you so much.